This is a production of Cornell University.
The time is now 4:45. The student assembly meeting October 13th. That meeting, clerks call order. Clerks would call the roll.
Need the mic.
That'd be great.
Mic.
The mic.
No. Block?
Yes.
So, Ballard?
Yes.
Breeden?
Yes.
Brown? Chopra?
Yes.
Desai?
Yes.
Adam Gitlin?
Yes.
Ron Gitlin?
Yes.
Goldberg?
Yes.
Gorjani?
Yes.
Hoffman? Kay?
Not
yet. Kerr?
Here.
Lee? Mellon?
Here.
Mueller?
Here.
Mueller? Nicoletti?
Here.
Pinky?
Here.
Rao?
Yes.
Delpo?
Here.
Smith? Bowman?
Professor?
Here.
Wolfram? Here. Yeah. We're going to move on now to approval of minutes. I'm going to call it out. Everyone yesterday, are there any motions?
Second.
Before we go to open microphone, we have a presentation by Gilbert Delgado, Andrew, Margaret, and Tim Marshall. Gilbert is a university architect. Andrew is also a university architect in Boston. And Tim Marshall is the director of mental health initiatives at Gibbet, also a school. They are presenting.
We can make it happen.
Well, thank you all for the opportunity to come back and talk with you again to provide you an update on where we are with this project. Primarily to be a presentation by Gilbert and Andrew, but I wanted to just set the stage in the context of this by showing you this framework once again, which underscores that means restriction is one part of our comprehensive approach to suicide prevention and mental health promotion for students at Cornell. So it's a comprehensive framework that looks at multiple dimensions and multiple strategies, of which this is one. And I just wanted to mention that among other things, we expanded our clinical services to counseling and psychological services this year, and also the Friend-to-Friend program, which is an educational initiative to help students better recognize and respond to friends that may be struggling emotionally. Is something that we're also building on. And if you're interested, this week's Cornell Chronicle is an article about the Friend-to-Friend program. But with that background and broader context, I'll turn it over to my colleagues.
Thank you, Jim. Good afternoon. Last podcast we presented to you, we showed you the results of several months after where we included our architect Nada had developed different solutions and bridges. We reached out to the community, reached out to campus. We had a lot of participation. We had a website where you could actually come in and comment on what your design work. And then we put everything together. We came up with a series of preferred options. Now, in all the bridges, we always had to line one of the teams being a net team, which was something that was usually below the bridge, that you would not see from the sidewalk to the street or the sidewalk, unless you looked over the handrails and looked down. We had always considered a very light gauge stainless steel mesh that if at the 50 or 40 feet, which is where you would see it, would be very difficult to see, especially with something in the background. So we took those designs to the planning board and discussed this with them. Also during that period, we also had heard that in Switzerland, they were employing the same type of fence systems in Switzerland. So we were very curious. There were a lot of questions regarding maintenance. There were questions regarding how to rescue people. There were questions about how to solve this. As I went into Switzerland, we were able to see firsthand how all this was done. They were very gracious. They showed us how to rescue people. They showed us how these things were attached. And what was really important to us was we saw how difficult they were to see in some ways. So we took some photographs and brought them back. So you try to get a better understanding as to what exactly we're talking about. So the interesting thing that we saw, five bridges, and the interesting thing was that lots of bridges were almost interchangeable with the landscape that we have here. We had bridges that were over kind of much more, you know, the landscape was much more evident. We had bridges that had, combined with a vehicular bridge type. So we actually were able to kind of tag, oh, this is a Stewart Avenue bridge type, or you know, this is a Lake bridge type, and we were able to find those examples in Switzerland. So these are the things that we observed. One was they had something to say, taxier setting. I know we love our landscape, they love our landscape too. Some of these devices were in areas that were just to say taxier. We'll see some of that. They were very difficult to see, unless you actually pulled because of the lightness of the material and because of how they were situated relative to the geometry of your body and the bridge itself. Thirdly, in talking with the superintendent, the public works superintendent, they were really low maintenance. Stainless steel, they were very simple, they were very robust, minimal maintenance. But the community accepted without any kind of problem these bridges in areas that were spectacularly beautiful. And in Bern, Switzerland, where they installed the Munster Terrace, they used to have two suicides a year. When they put these up, it went down to zero. And because of that, they have two other very dramatic bridges that connect the city center to the rest of the landscape. They have a plan to actually install additional sets of nets surrounding the river. So here's the first one that we saw the high bridge. If you look down the axis, you can see that you don't see anything. You actually have to go over on the side. You can see it's a beautiful vista, the beautiful landscape. It's very pedestrian bridge, similar to some of the pedestrian bridges that we have, probably a longer span. And then down below, you see the attachment for the bridge. But what you can see are the actual supports. You can't see the mesh from the very smart bridge. This is a Munster Terrace, overlooking the ledge. You can see the mesh becomes very, almost like it's the net, right? It's something a very light area. And from the bottom, again, we can see the supports. Now, we have, in our case, we have bridges that already have significant structural systems for the bridge itself. So that case would be a matter of extending that structural system. So it's part of the bridge. And, you were very curious in terms of how these things were actually built. You see it's relatively simple. And yet, if you look at that, you can see why 20 years, 30 years would go by, and really, it should not present any kind of issues. One thing that we have heard about the net that we're concerned with are people throwing things into the net. The Swiss reported no problem with that. And they were so generous to show us how this was, this is their fire department showing how they actually rescued people. They had different ways to do it. They had a wrench, they had a truck, they actually blew a little family down instead of sending it off. So, I want to give you that. I wanted to show you, because the photographs are sometimes difficult to understand the whole spatial relationship. So we took a video down the axis of the bridge, and then over and around the handrail, so you can see the relationship of what you have to do to actually see the net. There you go. Go back. Just look at these. You don't see anything. You have to look inside. And then that is the same. So because of the discussions that we had with the planning board, because of our experiences in Switzerland, because this is a case study that already provides for success, because it maintains the important vistas, we believe that wherever possible that we would go with a horizontal net system below the bridge. The exception that we made was the suspension bridge, because there we saw an opportunity to actually take down the handrail and actually create a piece of sculpture in the landscape, but one that would also allow you to appreciate your surroundings to an unprecedented level, one that to have an experience you currently do not have today. So with that, Andrew and I will show you for the final outcome of this design. Moreover, we have tweaked the roof so we've been able to minimize the coverage of the net to cover those areas that present the greatest danger to someone that has that moment. Moreover, at one point we also used the horizontal net as a vertical system to protect what's called the abutment. Right? But then what we learned in doing that was that whereas the bridges are man-made and bilaterally symmetrical, the extension of the bridges, right, to these horizontal systems, makes a lot of sense. It's a man-made composition against the landscape. Then what happens? It means stuff, other types of geometry. And it didn't really seem to work as well together. So what we decided to do was to use the flat fencing system that's already employed around the world to actually cover those areas. So with that, Andrew.
Okay, so what you see here is a map showing the four bridges that are part of the project, Ball Creek, and then three bridges on Castle Creek. So at Ball Creek, you have the suspension bridge, the BBM bridge, Collie Bridge, Stone Arch, and then also city bridges down below are Anderson, Stewart, and Stewart at Ball Creek. I'm going to start with Anderson Ave. And here's a view of the bridge showing where the nets would be. So you have that on both sides. The vertical fencing that you can see at the abutment over there on the left, as Gilbert mentioned, that's actually below bridge deck level, so it's really not going to pull down in the landscape. And the idea was to protect the bridge abutments down below that bridge deck, just to make it very difficult to get to those areas, closing those areas off. And so here's a view of the bridge before, and then here's an after showing the struts extending out from the bridge. The struts are painted to match the bridge. They virtually disappear, and then also the mesh is painted black, so that also is not very visible. This is the Cascadilla Creek Stewart Ave Bridge. It's got a harsh truss to it, and here again you see the mesh system down below. This is an illustration, so what you're seeing the mesh is actually much more, much less visible in real life. But again, you can see, you know, mesh on both sides, and then some strategic posing on the underside of the bridge above and below the bridge deck level. So here's the before view, looking down the gorge, and then here's with on your own?
Well, it does give, if you were to land in, it's a little stretch to give, but you won't roll off because you're waiting for you to descend. So, again, that's possibly what I was considered. I mean, I think one of the issues of being traditional is that someone has been in the office is that when you land in that, you still kind of come to realization. I mean, most people, interviews from people who attempt suicide, jumping, survive, they actually, when interviewed later, the first thing that came to mind was they made that initial jump and said, the worst mistake of their life. They come to that realization. So, we will hopefully save lives on this and everybody works on this. But I think we'll have a good time. Yeah, actually, it's very interesting. This is a really term. Since they put the attempt up on London terrorists in 1999, there's been no people in attempts, whether pranks or attempting suicides. So they function in that
way.
That's a very good question. We haven't heard this or not that one. But what happened in our time is called chamber is a double. We have a thermal sensor system that detects a hot object or warm object and set a certain size, and then that'll run. Yeah, that was good. Yep, that's correct. So everything you see now, black grid panels, that's all temporary panels that will be removed. All of these will be in this country, which is really great. They actually have a very good service life. They should last up to 20 or 30 years. Stainless steel is quite durable, so we're pretty confident that it's a very robust system.
So we're going to open the speaker list at the end of the presentation. So if there are any more questions, feel free to just raise your hand.
Okay, moving over to Stewart Bridge over Fall Creek. Here again, you can see that the system, on both sides, they're set about 50 feet below the guardrail height. These fences that you see along the perimeter there, these are actually existing fences that Cornell Plantations had installed along the borders for safety purposes. So here is the before view of this box across the bridge, and then those struts that extend out again in any green. I think this is a spectacular view from that bridge looking at that. So that I think the view will be preserved. Let's take a look at the suspension bridge. As Gilbert mentioned, one bridge we're not using that system. We're actually using the mesh to wrap around the existing tensile structure, suspension structure. And you can see a view there before and after. So this is a much lighter gauge cable mesh. But I think what's really spectacular is you've got these bars that were put in, I don't know, 30 years ago or so. For 4 meters restriction at that time. And they're about at eye level when you're on the bridge. And now we'll remove those, expose the open truss system, and then wrap the bridge with the cable mesh. And it'll also open up just along the center of the whole area. This mesh system wraps the entire bridge. And then as you get to the outside, it supports the suspension towers that go into the sky. So it's actually a very interesting system. This is the BDM footbridge. And again, here, we've looked at kind of minimizing the amount of horizontal netting. Here, we're just covering more painful areas and also reducing the amount of fencing. We're actually getting rid of all the fencing out of the bridge net. Here's a before, and then there's an after. This is the
here again, same strategy as the other with two panels on each side, covering those moving areas. Here you see there, this view, you see the black ribbon ends, and now it's gone. And then here's the stone arch bridge in Collegeton. This one is very unique, it's a very iconic stone bridge. Couldn't use a metal strut system to make it work in that specific way. So here we're actually using a fly end system where we're creating two attachment points, one on each side of the porch, made by cable, and then attached back to the stone bridge itself. So here's a before view. There's the after view. So that's really just part of the design. So any other questions?
Since there were a bunch of questions during the presentation, we're going to open up the speakers list, but just two more questions. Maybe for Johnny. The timeline of the implementation, how long is this going to take, and how much you're going to improve and how much you're going to be improved by the USA overall.
Right now we're involved in getting our municipal approvals for the city and the board, and also permission to install all the city bridges. We're hoping to have those approvals by the end of the year if possible, and then also finish up the kind of construction documents that we've got to get, and if we get our approvals, start construction in the spring. At a time, the duration of construction for a bridge is like about 6 weeks or so for a bridge.
Referee.
Thank you, appreciate it. Thank you guys for coming. I think we'll be able to see the game play on where the bridge is on. But my question was grid-wise, did you guys just use the case lift instead of needing the improvement of the horizontal lift on the right of the base on the top of the rest of the time, so any other kind of questions for
you? Yeah, that's a good question. The reality is that it's a special structure, different from other structures. So it has issues with wind load, also stand extremely long, and passings really. It's all the design passings haven't been as strong as the other bridges compared to other people. So really the choice initially was driven by structural issues. But from the standpoint of that type of bridge, you really just can't put a structure. And that's why I think the meshes actually it is very nice in a lot of ways.
Thank you very much for coming in the second. I really appreciate you taking the time and telling me. basically it's right up, you know, ahead of trustee weekend, basically get the concerns of the campus that has supported by next Tuesday, the 18th, and 102. Moving on to next announcement, Zoe Nelson, who's with the Capital Semester Program, is coming to speak to us about the Capital Semester Program in Albany.
Hi, thank you for having me tonight. I'm actually, you represent, Capital Semester. Government relations for Cornell, so I'm one of several state lobbyists for Cornell, and I work and live in Albany, and so I represent Cornell's interests and the interests of general higher education from the state of New York to the executive legislature and legislature. So saying that, I have a very close relationship with a lot of the members of the legislature. We deal with all branches of government on a daily basis. And this program is Capital Semester, it's internships with both the New York State Senate and New York State Assembly. And I personally feel very strongly that they are really great opportunities. And I thought Student Assembly, who clearly you care about the policies that affect your lives, this would be, in a broader sense, working with real policy, the interplay between policy and politics in New York State government. So it's a spring semester program, and you can intern in a member's office, so either the New York State Senate or the Assembly. You do real work, take constituent meetings, work with lobbyists, general office duties, and really learn a lot about the legislative process in that time. Outcomes, generally, Cornell students do really well in these internships. A lot of times you're asked to stay on the council session and work through the summer to the end, past the academic session, but stay through the end of the legislative session and stay on in that office more. Oftentimes, these lead to job opportunities within the Senator Assembly right after graduation. There have been several Cornell students that have gone through this program, and then, interviewing for the budget and fiscal policy groups for the legislature. They stay there for a little while. It's a great stepping stone to law school, other government positions, lobbying, along the track. It's not limited to poli sci majors, certainly. They accept all majors. I find it being really beneficial for students who are interested in a policy area, education or environment, labor, to actually go through and take a look at how those policies are made. This is a really great way to do that. And that leads you to be a better advocate for your causes and also to create policies that you want to see. I hosted an info session for all interested students tomorrow at 4:30 in MDR 153. And so we can have a longer chat. You can ask specific questions. Hopefully, you'll either recommend it to friends or hopefully come to
what time is that?
4:30 p.m. MDR 153. Just about an hour. I have applications as well for both programs. Sophomores, juniors, and seniors are eligible. However, sophomores are only eligible to the Senate, and international students are only eligible to the Assembly. So if you have specific questions on that, any questions about it, specific issues. It's only a spring semester program. Applications for this spring, I do next week with me. Coming a little bit close, but the plan is everything taking a look for either next year or the year after. You're all welcome to questions.
Thank you.
Thank you, everyone.
Thank you.
resource allocation to the university, alumni outreach, risk management, and have a legitimate club sports president at the university.
Great, thank you, John. For
the semester, do you think, yeah, is it something that
plus 4 is included. And I think that the middle ground we have to strike is between, you know, receiving a larger amount of funding and being guaranteed that larger amount versus having the risk of getting no funding at all, or just having the plus 4 from that the extreme of detrimental to an organization. Yeah, that being said, I know that the FAA is already contacted you about the advanced options, so you guys should be able to receive at least $4,000 for a semester. For the plus 4 that, you know, you operate one semester a year, in the short term, that should be able to alleviate the problem you guys have, which should be at about the level of funding that you would have received for one semester last year. If you are a two semester plus 4, then that's, you know, another issue moving forward that the FAA would be happy to work with you in addressing. I know on, you know, the idea that was floated of plus 4 being violent funded, this is something that I actually looked into for the past 2 years, and maybe, you know, Ari, I'm just trying to think about how you can talk about this a little bit more. But the concern that had come up in the past is that if there were to be another plus 4 violent funded organization, so to speak, then that would need, you know, if those offices were to take that, that would need, you know, coordination among student groups, but primarily the administrative support would be what we want to be on. I mean, if student organizations can show that they can shoulder the brunt of that, then this would be, you know, a low maintenance task for administrative support to take up. That's definitely something we could look at moving forward. And finally, the last point I wanted to make was, I think that your recommendations for the SAC process are excellent. Specifically, I'm looking at groups on, you know, a more holistic approach and not just looking at a brief documentation. I don't know how familiar other members are with this, but that's exactly what the ECSA does and how they allocate money. And I think that incorporating elements like this into our process is benefit, you know, not only plus for the student body as a whole. As far as you were talking about the amount of funding, I want to clarify to the audience, the rest of the assembly, that, you know, in no way has the SA cut the amount of funding that the SA has been able to give. In fact, Larry, correct me if I'm wrong, or Kari, but this is a vote that the SA has had to allocate in a single year in the history of the organization, the history of the university. You know, like Vice President Lincoln said, he's already outlined why the cuts have been so much slower than like that. The SA will be going through the funding process in the next coming week. I know it's still up for debate whether or not they will receive more money, but then hopefully that will also be a stick towards alleviating the problems that you've brought up. I hope that you do stay in communication with us, you know, come to a long-term solution instead of just a semester by semester basis. Thank you again for coming.
Thank you so much,
Bob. Okay, so I do have a few things. The semester advantage option works for a few of the students. The only way it would ultimately work, though, is if we really change the funding process for next semester. And that, like, the way it stands now is that if we do the advanced option, then we're left with zero funding before the spring. And there are a few teams that are single semester, but a lot of the major ones who are being hurt the most are two semester sports, and it's still a decrease overall of about $5,000 in funding. But if we can work on something in the spring, then that can definitely be an option for us. And I will, in terms of us in relation to the rural organizations, obviously there's other organizations that are being affected pretty heavily by this as well. I would say that at Club Sports, there is a slight difference in how heavily we rely on funding for operations in general. It's not that if we don't get money, we can't hold a certain event. We don't get funding, we can't operate at all. We can't participate in our leagues, we can't play games, and the entire core foundation of our team is not sustainable. So I feel like it's a different type of priority, not necessarily greater than other organizations, because I'm in a bunch of other organizations too, and I want to make sure they get money as well, but it's just a different category for consideration.
Okay,
so I just wanted to mention that the effects of retail throughout every SAP group and a lot of different communities, a lot of different types of organizations are sort of having to restructure their entire yearly operations because of the lower budget. And as one of those organizations are really gaining. The question I have for you, could you sort of take us an example of the types of costs that Club Sports face and what making the course big costs are really limited?
An example, a simple entry fee for a tournament could be upwards to $900. Travel alone, you know, can be a few hundred if you're going anywhere. Our referees follow anywhere. I'm speaking most of all of my team that I was part of. It's obviously just for different reasons. But our referees run anywhere from $150 to $200 per game. So that very quickly builds up as you go throughout the year. Another thing which I didn't have time to talk about, but it's just facility use. In the spring, we get very limited use from the university. We have to go off campus. In the spring, we spend at least $1,300 to use off-campus facilities. Last semester, we ended up actually not getting anything through almost most of the semester, and we actually left without any place to practice to make sure that doesn't happen. We're planning on spending $2,000 upwards just on facilities. And then that's just a practice to kind of improve the game. So very quickly, those costs get pretty high.
And the other question is,
No, they don't. It's during regular operating hours.
I see people buying and raising hands.
Or most guys, it's different for ISIS.
Yeah.
Okay.
A lot of people
are
in the Years, water polo hasn't had to pay for lifeguarding, but with the new aquatics director, although we have trained and certified lifeguards on our team, and we're all strong swimmers, we spend about $1,500 a semester on lifeguarding, and that's just for lifeguards, that's not even for using the pool for tournaments and traveling, so.
Great,
could
you just
say
your name
and
your
director,
just so we
have.
For all those that now on the team, so we're just going to go through the one-on-one, unless you want to. We're just going to go through the culture representative. So just in case you guys can sit on any of the chairs up here. Next comes leader of instruction in the round.
Helping us to work this out. I represent the two-year skating club, and to give you an idea of our costs just to practice at the university, Liner Rink charges us $190 per hour. And we practice for 3 hours a week. And to put that in perspective, other clubs that have about the same amount of members and the same amount of elite-level figure skaters on their teams are probably having 7 to 10 hours per week. So we're already at, you know, a conservative amount of practice time. And we are doing stuff to restructure our schedules. You know, we're charging more for dues. We're going to, like, tap into alumni fundraising. So, I mean, we acknowledge that, like, the cuts are what they are, and we need to do our part to sort of meet that new requirement. However, you know, the nature of each club sport makes it, you know, our requirements are very different. Regional competition is not really something that's feasible for us, and we only compete like 3 times a year, so to be able to travel to those is very important to us, but it is more expensive. So there is definitely sort of a, I guess, subjective nature to this, because clubs sort of require different amounts and different things.
I appreciate the correspondence that you had with myself and the chair of
that. Yeah, no, and I thank you guys for that too. I appreciate it.
This is going to be quick. I just wanted to compliment you on getting together so quickly and talking to us about this, because I really just want to remind everyone that it's certainly not isolated to club sports. They have been really great about getting organized and talking to us soon, but you know, particularly with performing groups, as a involved performance group myself, I can tell you that this trickles to some groups. Some are well more along than others because of their own personal plans, but particularly with groups like club sports and a lot of our performance groups that represent Cornell around the country, around the world, you know, that have albums come out of the that win tournaments that put our name everywhere. If these are groups that are perhaps in restructuring the way the SAFC looks at things, those are things to consider, because they benefit many more students than you can see signed up on the member list. So,
yeah, again, thank you for having us. I'm representing the club hockey team. I'm the president, but Woody back there is the vice president. And the only thing I want to say is that a lot of things that we have to do in terms of costs, I want to go back on that. We raised dues since I've been here as a freshman, $150 per person. It used to be around $650. The year before I came in, I heard it was $550. So it's gone up since then. Now we're now at $800 a person just for this year. The only problem with, like, restructuring around costs is that we're in a league, a pretty competitive league. It's called the Northeastern Collegiate Hockey League, and the reason, like, this year is a big deal is because we can't just move around our schedule and things, because the league set certain dates and we have to work around them, and there's a lot of games to be played. So the big thing that's hurting us is that we will get fines if, you know, we don't show up for games, things like that. We also have, like, requirements to the league for uniform requirements. Everyone has to have a certain amount of, you know, red helmet, you know, red pants, things like that. So a lot of the dues that we have, it's tough for us to restructure, and I just want to put that out there in terms of whoever's asking about where the, you know, some of the costs are coming in. So thank you very much.
At the end of the day, like, the best thing, if we were to get, like, a
$200,000 grant or something of the like, which we can use to over allocate to keep them like rollover from year to year. That's something we can do. Like, go, you know, the alternative to that is like we take money out of the FCC budget every year, which is counterintuitive when you just allocate the money. We are looking at ways to try and like work around that, maybe change the rule, and it's right now the legal impediment.
And I think that
part of that would be an administrative support. Like Eliana would say, we met, I think we can implement like an administrative officer to support, like even if that office would be coordinating funding for all the organizations, because a lot of kids we make point out and say that the system's more rigid and more like, I guess, more structured. And I think that it would be important for us. We have, I think, a leading office in the office. I think it would be an important initiative for Club Sports, which is something to coordinate some sort of administrative position to get funding to go through the online office and not figure out the FDA. I think that would be a possible solution. If, yeah, I don't know if a lot of
yeah, actually, right now, we're having to get a lot of I'm looking at a lot of other schools as models. If all the driving programs are really good, all the driving are really good post-school programs, like looking through their handbooks, and, they all have administrative integration. So I've been kind of using that to throw together our program.
One more thing.
Positive to do so without actions and then we're trying to wait.
interdisciplinary club where we're going to be able to solve problems in the city, and where all students are really going to be able to test them. So just some things that are occurring right now. So for all applying or responding to an RFP, which is due October 28th, so you immediately for now we'll officially apply for this. The minimum of that Mayor Bloomberg wants is 250,000 square feet, even phase one, and eventually a whole campus of 1 million square feet. So this will be a pretty big proposal. We're proposing to put the site on Roosevelt Island, which is across the river from Wild Medical Center. And you can look at how successful Wild has been. You can see that Cornell is highly successful. I think the satellite campuses can do this with this specific campus. And as far as money goes, so what the city is going to provide is the land and up to $100 million. Obviously, Cornell is going to be having to spend some money, and that is really something that we can even consider, the fact that Cornell will be spending money. But talking with many of the administrators, they're very sure that if you're chosen at a new campus, chosen for schools like Stanford, you're going to get a lot of money. And more importantly, the money that they get back over time is going to make this worthwhile. So we think that as far as the investment goes, this is a really great thing. More importantly, Cornell,
just to tell you guys a few things that we're doing. If you go to cornellstudentsnyc.com, that's the right address. Working on creating videos to get the word out about this on campus. We have a few blurbs from students, and we actually have a meeting later tonight, and we are going to be thinking about different things that we can be doing with, that would get the word out, that would get support. There's also currently the alumni started a petition on change.org to get as much support with the tech campus as possible. So if you guys want to go there, we'll send out the link also. Just spread the word. It would really, we really appreciate it.
All
yours right now.
Alright. Is there anyone else on the speaker list? Representative Freeman.
Right, so the last one will create the opportunity to help publicize the movement, but also allow us to organize. Basically, by voting yes, stay here saying that this student body wants this campus, and we support this. Just to kind of wrap it up, the reason why I'm being presented now is A, because the deadline is the 28th, but also we didn't have the opportunity. Basically, by voting yes, you're saying that the student body wants this campus and that we support this. We think that was a big competitive advantage, especially looking to the efforts of Stanford versus Cornell. We think that Cornell students want this more, and I think we'll do a better job at creating a tech campus in New York City.
All right,
I'm
speaking to Representative
There's nobody in the room, I can talk about it. Meller, Mueller, and Mueller is really confusing. I just want to say I absolutely believe in this as an investment. I was just eager to hear if the administration had laid out what the short-term, my remaining, for example, 2 years here, what the short-term cost to student activities and other programs will be. Obviously, there's a lag in return on investment on this sort of thing, and they're going to be putting a lot of money into it in the near future. I don't know where the money is coming from in the short term, and I'm hesitant at this particular moment to unanimously, you know, with my full support, approve this, because I don't want it to suddenly affect students negatively just for a couple of years before it really comes back.
Right. So what's been made public on the conference will be talked about is that the provost office has that on the funding model for the site campus, which consists of the first initial $100 million from the city of here. It also consists of research grants and contracts from the government, along with contracts with companies and foundations as well as with so they think that overall the actual money that we're spending in hours will be minimized a lot by getting these contracts with government pieces and fill the problem that we have to do that.
Yeah, I was going to ask you earlier, somewhat similar to what John was talking about. I was wondering if you have sort of any more information that we actually can look at besides just more, I guess, generic basic sort of talking points that have been presented. Because, I know I've heard this sort of presentation multiple times, and I was just sort of hoping that I see sort of, you know, more about than what I see in any of this. Like, you know, what type of study is going into, and exactly, you know, what
Yes, I can answer specifically. So, what's really cool about the tech campus is that it's an IDNA hub, which is all from. So, the four hubs, four main hubs are mobile social interaction, intelligent cross-related services, technologies for a healthier life, and smart technologies for the built environment. So, that's what we can tell you. Again, the reason why we can't, you know, come out and make it public is because we don't know a lot of things. Like the trustees still have to, you know, approve the proposal and do on the committee. And at the end of the day, they're not going to be specifically public because the proposal is a private thing until it's submitted on the 28th. So what we can tell you is that it's made public, but we really believe in this project. We really know that this is a new great thing for
all.
Different programs at different universities.
we talked about innovation, the monetization program, red light that looks at policy, then I think communications would be responsible for figuring for determining the best method for actually gathering information. So Ari, great. So Ari actually emailed us a great source for coming up with or for things the university was doing surveys, and so Mary and I came up with the last thing, the question was it's very long. But so that's what we're looking at in a nutshell. Thank you.
I just want to make another really quick comment. University is further involved. The second obvious is first is further involved of the student health task force and
communication. Oh no, they're the communication. But that's not in the chart. That's in the chart. That was on the chart. Right. That was in the chart for real. Oh.
Just wanted to applaud you guys for keeping an open mind and actually looking into this as opposed to just saying, focusing on that, student assembly endorses no more smoking than going on campus. And I'm eager to hear about the results of the investigation inquiry, whatever you want to call it. Referendum.
Not a referendum. And I can just say that in all the campuses that we've looked at where you have successful changes in smoking policy, it's always come out of that.
This has been a production of Cornell University, on the web at cornell.edu.